Welcome to the Exec MBA Podcast. I'm your host, Brett Twitty, and you are listening to a new episode. On this episode of the podcast, I'm excited to share a recent conversation I recorded with Yael Grushka-Kokain. Yael is a member of the Darden faculty, and she is also Senior Associate Dean for Professional Degree Programs here at the Darden School and the new leader of our Executive MBA program. We recently caught up to talk more about Yael's background, what brought her to Darden, her teaching in the decision analysis area, as well as our plans for the start of school. So with that said, I think you're going to really enjoy this conversation. So without further ado, here is my interview with Yael. Yael, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you. It's great to be here. I'm excited about this.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. Congratulations on your new role. We're going to be talking about that. And so great to have you here on the podcast. And I've been looking forward to this conversation ever since your role was announced. I was like, we got to get Yael on the podcast. So it's all happening.
That's awesome. I'm excited. I'm excited about the role. I'm excited to get to work with you, Brett, and with the amazing team in the executive format. So many, individuals who have been around Darden for so long, and I have not had an opportunity to work this closely with. So I'm excited.
Well, let's get into it. Tell us a little bit more about your role and a little bit about your background.
Sure. So I'm a professor in the QA unit at Darden. So I teach quantitative analysis. That actually doesn't mean a lot for students right now because the course is technically called decision analysis or DA. And so I teach decision analysis. I've been at Darden for 11 years now. Gosh, I joined in 2009 on the ending, or actually the height of the previous recession. I joined as a junior professor, and I've been at Darden since. I teach decision analysis. I teach project management as an elective to our students and to executives around the world. And I teach data science in the recent years, which has been exciting. My new role is a senior associate dean for professional degree programs. That includes the executive MBA format. It includes the MSBA and other exciting initiatives that Darden has on the horizon. Basically everything that is not the residential program, which I'm very excited about. I've been involved with the residential program primarily since I joined, and this is time for me to venture outside the world of the residential program and to get to work with other students in other formats, students who are working, students who are working professionals who have a slightly different perspective, and develop them and help them get to their next level of professional excellence and leadership with them. So I'm excited to be here. I will say that I've spent the most recent 2 years away from Darden. So I was on a leave of absence at Harvard Business School, and it's been great to be away, but it's even better to be back. I've missed Darden. I've learned a lot. It was a good time for me to take a break, take some perspective, and I'm coming back full steam to work with you and the team and the students on dealing with the near-term necessities and a long-term vision for Darden's growth and development.
And you're right to note all the exciting things that Darden has in the working professional category. Lots happening in the Washington, D.C. area. You'll get to spend a little bit more time in Roslyn, I'm guessing,
than you have in the past. On the road from Charlottesville to Roslyn often and spending time in Roslyn. I have colleagues that I work with closely in Georgetown. I've enjoyed visiting the Roslyn facility in the past. I've taught quite a lot of executive education courses there, even before the actual facility was built. I've worked with folks in the DC area and the federal government in all kinds of executive formats, teaching a lot of my coursework. So I'm excited to be there more regularly and strengthen my bonds with that community.
Well, let's go back a little bit further in your story, because I think our listeners would be really interested to hear more about life before Darden. So where'd you grow up?
Oh, gosh. You're going to regret asking me this question, because my story, it turns out that over the years, it's I've hopped around a lot. So there's a lot of different legs and parts of the story to tell. I grew up in Israel. So my childhood, I see myself, I'm Israeli. Yael is a very Israeli name. I grew up in Israel. I did my schooling there as a youngster, and I did my military service in the IDF for 3 years. We do that after high school. So I did that immediately after high school. And then I did my bachelor's degree in industrial engineering and management, still in Israel, where my family lives until today. So my first half of my year, of my life I spent in Israel. I was actually born in the U.S. I'm American by birth, but I moved to Israel as a very young toddler. So that's my first chunk of life. And then following my degree, I moved to the States, and I've been basically away from Israel ever since. So the second part of my life, I've been away. I lived in San Francisco for 2 years working. I was selling enterprise resource planning systems. I was doing software, as people did back around the year 2000. And I enjoyed living on the West Coast, but I really missed academia. And so I decided to go back. I got my master's and my PhD. By then I moved to London. So I was living in the UK for quite a while. And I got my master's from the London School of Economics in operations research. And then my PhD in management science and operations from the London Business School. Fields, management science, operations research, decision analysis, which I teach and do a lot of my research on. They're very related fields. They're also related to industrial engineering, which is what I did my bachelor's in. So it's all different ways of kind of, you know, giving a title to the same kind of subfields. It's all about, you know, the science that is in management and in planning businesses. How do you optimize processes? How do you think systematically about decisions? How do you plan production? How do you plan different, you know, resourcing activities? Those are all kind of problems that folks in my field deal with. Specifically, I, in my research, focus on project management and forecasting, to what seems unrelated topics, but they actually merge quite nicely because there's a lot of forecasting that goes into planning projects. But they're very broad in nature, very applicable to many industries. And so I like to say that my work, you know, relates to almost everybody in the workforce, regardless of what company or industry they're in. And so straight out of PhD, I moved to Darden, and that's where I've been located since. My husband is British. We actually met in San Francisco, but we moved together to England. And I had one child born in England, one child born in Charlottesville. So we are really a multinational household, with, you know, every one of us has dual passports and so on. So it gets confusing at times, but it is what it is.
Did you always know, you mentioned being born in the States and then moving to Israel. Did you always know that you're going to come back to the States at some point?
I didn't rule it out. First, my dad was an academic too. My dad was a professor. He was a very proud professor. He loved his job. He always said it wasn't a job, but it was, you know, a hobby that he got paid to do. And he just was a very proud professor that studied at court. He was Israeli. He grew up in Israel. Technically, he was born in the days before Israel when it was still Palestine. He did his PhD at in Cornell, and he loved the academic vibe in the US. And so even when I was young and we were in Israel, when we eventually moved there, he always spoke, you know, nostalgically about academic life in the US in general, that there's just a good set of institutions, there's a good culture around it, there's a lot of opportunities. And so it was almost like always out there as an option. And so I never ruled it out. I have, you know, my mom is American, so we have lots of family around here, not immediate family, but her broader family. So we've always gone back and forth. So it's not been a completely foreign idea to me. Israelis never like to say that they leave Israel. It's something that has for decades been very difficult to come to terms with leaving Israel. But I'm very happy here. I'm happy with my job. I miss my family very much. And I go home to Israel as often as I can, but this is where I live right now. And since my husband is British and his family is in England, this is kind of neutral territory for us. We have to, you know, we bring our family here to visit us, as often as we can. And we're very happy with what we have here. So such is life, right?
Right. I imagine having a father who's a professor might have put the idea of being a professor in your mind at an early age, particularly given his enthusiasm for his occupation. hobby, so to speak, that you got paid for. Did you know that you were going to, I mean, when did it hit you that you were going to be an academic and pursue that path?
That's a great question. Probably a long, I mean, I've always had this fascination with teaching. Ever since I was a little girl, this was always the role play that I took upon myself. And I've heard that from others, that kind of, there are some people that just gravitate towards those kind of roles. I always found it fun to think about instructing others. And from a very young age, even in elementary school, I would, you know, volunteer to like tutor or help others or teach. Some of my best friends until today, I met through, you know, having, they just joined like school and they were asking for kids volunteer to, you know, catch them up on a topic that they didn't have in their previous school. And I always found myself in situations where I was putting on these tutorials or teaching. And then in my undergrad, I did more actual research as well as part of my dissertation for my degree. And I loved it. And I enjoyed taking complex ideas and explaining them in more accessible terms. And so it's been there, kind of out there all along, that this is something that I enjoyed doing. You know, I was a guide at Scouts. I was a leader, even in the Army, in the military. And my role was initially an instruction role. So I've always kind of gravitated and found myself in those types of roles. So it wasn't a huge surprise to anybody who knows me that I would find, you know, a lot of passion for academia and be drawn back into it even when I tried to leave it. And then once I went back to my master's, it was a done deal. There was no looking back. And I've really been fortunate every day to feel very passionate about the role. I love, you know, periods of heavy research, periods of heavy teaching. I love the fact that Darden is a place where we're also pushed to innovate the pedagogy and think very creatively on what we teach and how we teach it. So I don't know if your listeners are always aware of the fact that professors at Darden do research like other professors do. We do teaching. We do the case method teaching, but we do teaching, which most professors have to teach as well. But we also write cases and write tech notes and write just in materials for the classroom that then we share with other business schools. And I love that additional dimension of the work at Darden because it allows us to think, you know, proactively about how, what is the best way to consume knowledge? What is the best way to transmit knowledge? And how do we create new knowledge with our students? And that's something that Darden allows me to do. And I'm very fortunate to be an institution that does that. So yeah, I think this is a good role for me. It's a good job for me. And most people who see me in my role or talk to me about my job can sense that enthusiasm because it's really something that I enjoy doing. I want to say every moment of the day. I will admit there are moments that are tough where I think to myself, maybe I should take a, you know, maybe I need to go to the pool or go for a run. But all in all, I really love it.
It's clear. I mean, you can hear it in your voice. And my mom is a teacher and taught for 40 years. And so growing up in that environment, I think if you are around teachers or people who do that as you know, their work, it kind of rubs off on you. Just it becomes part of who you are, and sort of hearing you sort of take on those roles from an early age at least resonates with me and some of the experiences I had growing up. So
yeah, it's really interesting. You know, when I think about it that way, my dad, given that he was a professor all those years, and he was in chemistry, so it was a different field, but he would regularly have his PhD students over. You know, I got to know them. In fact, I got so close to them from a very young age, like even, you know, when I was in elementary school, that when I was visiting HBS in the Cambridge area, I met up with my dad's former PhD students from almost 40 years ago. It's like, it's so, that bond is so strong, and that was really infused it from home. And it seems very natural to me.
That's incredible. One of the things we get asked about, it's a little bit of a tangent, but it's picking up on something you were just talking about, case writing. Many of our prospective students wonder where the ideas come from and how do you decide what to write about and how do you find out, get the information that you need? Can you talk a little bit more about what that process looks like?
Yes, of course. That's a great question. And one that I actually think that we should, you know, if we have time, we should always be transparent with our students, because I think it's really fascinating for them to know. It's also helpful as they think and read about the and learn from the cases. It's helpful for them to understand the process by which these cases were crafted. So there's two two probably main avenues, I would say, for case writing. One is when you come across an individual, a decision maker in a company that genuinely has a problem, and they pick up the phone and they say, oh, who better to call than that professor that I had in business school? Maybe it's my marketing professor or my accounting professor or my finance professor. So they pick up the phone. They say, hey, I have a problem. Can you help me think about it? Can you help me find solutions? And then that naturally kind of highlights a new and unique and timely decision-making moment in a real company that requires innovation. And we as faculty, we can help our alums in terms of give advice, but we can also shadow the situation and then end up writing a case on it. So it's almost like we get involved with some form of consulting that turns into a case. We help them find a solution, or we document their problem, and then we turn that into a case. And so those are problems that are driven from the decision makers, from the industry, and they come knocking at our door. The second avenue in which cases get formed is by us identifying gaps in our curriculum. So, you know, I started a project management course a few years ago, and I recognized that there weren't that many good cases on project management, not really recent ones, or they were missing a lot of the material that I wanted to cover. So I went out and looked for companies that were doing this type of work and probed around a little bit. And I found opportunities for case writing that would be useful. And so sometimes it's faculty driven based on curriculum needs, based on interest, based on research needs. So it really is, you know, one or the other. Like, I'm engaged in a new project with Eli Lilly now around predictions of successful development opportunities, successful drug development opportunities. And they're doing cutting edge probability forecasting in ways that relate very closely to my research. And so I'm working with them on this project with the hope that I can write a case on it, because it demonstrates some of the techniques that I develop in my work. I'm working on a similar type, not similar, but a related problem with the Ravens on how do you take scout assessments to come up with better predictions for a player's success. I'm working on and then a totally different type of case, right, that I'm, you know, just about to finish. 2 years ago, there was a story, you may have heard of this, of the boys, a football team of boys in Thailand that got stuck in the cave. Do you remember that instance?
I do.
An amazing, amazing rescue story with international divers that all came together to collaborate to rescue these boys. I don't think it's a secret right now to say that they were luckily all successfully rescued after 10 days underground with no food and no water. When I read that case back 2 years ago, as I was watching it unfold live in front of us on media in general, I recognize that there's a huge component of project planning and project management in this whole process. How did they, you know, think about this as a project? What contingencies did they put in place? How did they plan this project out? How did they execute it so flawlessly? And so I have spent 2 years interviewing all the divers and the Thai government and all these individuals who were personally involved. And I'm just finishing the case, and it will be available this summer for consumption. So those are kind of examples of cases that we stumble upon either from our research or that we are interested in that we think relate to topics that we teach our students.
Well, I've long dreamed of a podcast where we just have faculty come on to talk about their recent case. And so, man, those are three great cases that you are working on. The Thai one is fascinating. I wouldn't have imagined that as a project management case. You learned something new.
Well, I even got to a point where I laid it all out in a Gantt chart. I don't think anybody did. They did, actually, surprisingly, they boarded live in the field during the operation. They had something that wasn't exactly a Gantt chart, but it was basically a depiction with the geography of the cave. They had all the tasks and the flow of the information and the flow of even the boards underground mapped on the board in a way that really looked like a Gantt chart. It's fascinating. It's a fascinating case. It's been a lot of fun to study and just in awe of people's creativity in moments of real crisis.
But you also see how your research and maybe orientation towards how you think about things influences what you even conceive of as possibly being a case. Many people just followed that story and thought, well, that's an amazing story. And then you saw it and was like, gosh, it seems like there may be a project management element to that.
Oh, totally. I mean, I immediately kept, I was immediately drawn to it from a project management perspective. And then two other faculty at the time, this is at Harvard Business School, two other faculty reached out to me to say, we heard you're writing a case on this. We're also interested in it from these perspectives, which were, by the way, very different from mine. And we've basically collaborated, the three of us, on it. And their angles, one of them is into innovation, and one of them is into team dynamics. So very different angles, all studying it through the lens of the same case. Because if you think about it, a real proper case, or, you know, the fundamental of case studies, if we go back to the where Darden started, where Harvard Business School started, and where Darden originated, cases are very complex decision-making situations that have all facets of our curriculum. It's not that a case that a protagonist faces in reality is ever just a pure marketing case. It's a marketing case, but it's probably also an HR case. It probably has operational components to it. It has a lot of leadership in it, and it might have financial implications. Every situation is multidimensional. And this Thai rescue situation is not different. There are different aspects of what we think about as leadership and what we think about as leading organizations to successful outcome. There's different elements that shine through this case. And so it's been fun collaborating with folks that have a different agenda or a different, you know, lens by which they see situations. And we've been really building on each other in the process.
I'm so glad to hear you say that. I think there's two things that you said that really resonate with me. And I'm so glad our listeners have had an opportunity to hear about it. So one, the fact that even though a case may have a particular focus to it, it is multidimensional, and there's opportunity to look at it from many different angles and many different vantage points. It's integrative. And then two, that you and faculty members are connected to industry and looking at actual real life business problems, because this is a common question from prospective students, because they want to know, like, I think academia has this reputation of being abstract and kind of removed and ivory tower-ish. Not the case here at the Darden School, but it's worth repeating that this is very, very practical. Can be kind of one of these words that people look down on, but that's always, you know, that's the purpose here. We're trying to give you a sense for how this stuff really happens.
Totally. And this is why I'm here. I mean, this is one of the draws to Darden. It is a school that cares about research that matters to people in, you know, who are actually in the business world. And, you know, maybe if I tie it back to my new role, this is one of the things that I'm excited about with working with the executive format students, because I think the EMBA students, you know, they're working. They can tomorrow walk into the office and, you know, recognize the realism of the situation that we studied in the classroom in their working environment. The residential students eventually get there too, of course, but it's more of a delay. They more, you know, they study these topics while they're full time, and then they go out and experience them with a big shock in their summer internship. Suddenly everything comes at them from all dimensions. But yes, we care a lot about being relevant. We care that our work is translatable and that people outside care about it and that we can make a difference. And that's the beauty of the school, the interest, the faculty have this in common. And we indeed diffuse it into our classroom. And cases are the epitome of that, because it's how we make both our research and our teaching relate to actual decision makers, which really empowers us to deliver messages that the students should care about.
Let's talk a little bit about decision analysis, because some of our listeners may have heard you say that and be like, what exactly is decision analysis? Do you want to sort of help people orient to the topic a little bit?
Yeah, it's a good question. We always have to explain what decision analysis is, which sometimes I'm happy about, sometimes makes me wonder. But decision analysis is really about how we can think systematically about the decisions that we make. What do we need to think about? Why is it not obvious that we know how to make decisions? Well, decisions can be complicated. They can be multifaceted. They can have multiple stakeholders. They can have multiple goals and objectives that they're trying to satisfy. Sometimes those goals are, you know, conflicting with our actions. And we need tools to help us think in a way that is consistent, that we can communicate it, and that articulates the degree of risk that we're willing to take upon ourselves. And so Really, these are the topics that we touch upon when we teach decision analysis. I will say that it sounds vague and broad to some degree because it's so overarching. These are decisions that are made in various contexts. So these could be financial choices that an organization has to make. This could be an investment in a project. This could be a staffing decision or a production and manufacturing decision. This could be a marketing decision in terms of how much money to spend and what kind of channel to advertise in. These are all problems across the different areas that have the same components. There's multiple alternatives with a lot of uncertainty that affects the outcome, and we care about different objectives at the end of the day. And so when you put those things together and you want to apply a specific framework and you want to have a guiding framework for your decisions, you need a course like decision analysis to give you those principles. How do we measure, you know, what is a good decision? How do we separate decision making from the outcomes? How do we think in a systematic way so the organization thrives? What are some decisions and some metrics that we need to consider? And how can we help others around us feel more comfortable with the decisions that we make? It's a lot of fun to teach. It's, you know, I've loved teaching it for the past 11 years. Actually, I was involved in teaching it even as a PhD student at London Business School, but it's just fun because people find it useful personally in their personal life, and they also find it professionally rewarding and useful in the company environment. So I know that our incoming students will love it a lot. And I know that those rising students, the 2021s, will, you know, have a lot of fond memories. And sometimes it's not easy because there is some math, there is some analytics to it. But I think everybody finds it very rewarding and enlightening to think in those ways and to use those frameworks.
Yeah, I think about it as one of those. I mean, so it's one of the first courses students take in our executive MBA program. It's right up there in quarter one. We've had this ongoing prep series that we've been offering on an optional basis for our incoming students. The first module was actually with Robert Caraway in decision analysis. And the course can be kind of heavy on Excel, which not all students have, you know, total comfort with, depending on what they've done in their professional lives. And also, you mentioned there's math and some other things that may get students out of their comfort zones, depending upon their backgrounds. How do you get students comfortable with the topic, or how do you help them with the learning curve?
It's a great question. And so Excel or whatever tool you have, it's hard sometimes to kind of get out of the weeds and to remind students that these are tools and instruments that are helping aid our decision-making process and give us a way to think about the quants and the numbers involved, again, in a systematic way. But ultimately, we need to be able to tell the story. We need to step back and say, I'm recommending a certain decision X because of this trade-off. And if you go one route, you'll end up in one place. If you go to a different route, you'll end up in a different place. You need to articulate the story. And the whatever it is, if it's a calculator on your phone, if it's Google Docs or Google Sheets or Excel, or even if you use something more sophisticated like R or Python, at the end of the day, it is your role as the decision maker and as the leader to take that analytics and translate that into a decision that you get people's buy-in. And if you remind students as you progress that it's not just about the number crunching, but it's about stepping away and then interpreting it, then they realize what those tools are aiding us, are trying to aid us to do. And so that is like one of the things that we can help with in the classroom as facilitators, as faculty, is crafting those questions that help people zoom out a little bit and take a bigger perspective and say, okay, what have we just done here? What are all these numbers in the spreadsheet trying to tell us? Where is our objective here? How do we tell the story looking at this spreadsheet? And then we kind of separate it and we understand the principles and we don't obsess so much about whether or not I knew the function in Excel. And it's hard at first, again, because we get overwhelmed. And of course, we need to develop some capabilities or find those capabilities in our organization in terms of driving those numbers and coming up with those calculations. But at the end of the day, the calculations don't tell the story. We do. We make that decision. We tell the story. We make we draw the conclusion from the numbers, and that's what really requires the practice and the emphasis, not so much whether or not, you know, you put a cell in A1 or you put the cell in C7. We can argue about that or debate that, and that comes with time. So it's also putting the right emphasis and rewarding students on progressing in the right direction and not focusing on the machinery just for machinery's sake.
DA is one of those classes where we've also seen students who have a particular background in that area or related topics lead review sessions or help sessions for their classmates. The thing that we talk a lot about from the admissions side of things is the more quantitative courses or any of the courses at Darden, you both learn the sort of technical piece, but you also get an opportunity to practice your communication skills, develop your executive presence. And so I'm so glad to hear you talk about telling the story, right? Because that's what class is about. You have all these different people. They all have different ways of approaching the same problem. And everybody is in there having a conversation.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's part of the emphasis. DA, you mentioned before that DA is one of those first courses in the program, and that's been true for a while. And it's the connective tissue, if you will, among other courses, or it helps facilitate other courses in the sense that once we all have these tools, we can then indeed continue to use them in the specific context, either in a marketing course or in a finance course or in strategy even. So it is one of those kind of opening gambit courses that give everybody useful tools, but it is mostly about talking about it out loud. That's one of the, I think, the largest barriers that people have, that they know how to do some number crunching or they feel that they do, but then they kind of stop and halt when they're trying to explain it to other people. And it requires practice, as you say, but it's also a huge opportunity around our case method instruction. As again, you pointed this out, but I cannot strengthen that enough, because coming and talking about it and trying to articulate sometimes statistical terms, it's like suddenly you find yourself tripping up on all these terms and, ooh, do I want to say standard deviation? What is variance and mean mode? You know, all these terms, technical terms that we get ourselves wrapped up about. And we need to practice thinking out loud, correcting ourselves, pivoting with new input that comes in, and being dynamic in our thinking. And I think that we, our course and in general, the program enables students to do this very well. As the world grows into more and more analytical world, and companies are embracing data science, AI, and other technology, our MBAs in general and across the board are called to be more, I think McKinsey calls them translators, right? They need to feel comfortable talking the language of finance, talking the language with the accountants, understanding the marketing perspective or the marketer's mindset, but also understanding those engineers and those data scientists that come to them with questions or look upon them to provide that connection to the business side of things. And so that role of a translator requires, it's not, you can't just become a translator without having exposure or trying and practicing. And so I envision a lot of our MBAs doing that role. I've spoken to a lot of, you know, the EMBA students who see themselves in roles related to bridging that gap and serving in that position. And that's what this course helps prepare you to do.
Well, I could talk about, you know, sort of cases and curriculum all day, because I think it's such an interesting topic for our prospective students and our incoming students. But I do also want to take a little bit of time here on the podcast to talk about plans for the start of school. This is, you know, we are recording this in late June. Our executive MBA students will start with orientation on August 16. It'll be here before we know it. We're obviously thrilled to welcome the class of 2022. So we made an announcement, I guess, for the class last week in relation to this podcast. Shared an update about orientation LR1 and some of our initial planning for quarter one. Do you want to talk about that a little bit here?
Sure. Thank you, Brett. Yeah, this year is an interesting year, obviously, for obvious reasons. We're all facing unusual circumstances. They're becoming somewhat usual these days because we're into this pandemic situation for several months now, or nearly 4 months now. And so we are actively planning the year ahead, and we're balancing quite a few, you know, talk about a multi-stakeholder, multi-objective decision problem that we have on our hand. We are balancing balancing the different perspectives, we are balancing the different needs, and we're balancing our academic necessities to put the best program that we can forward for our students. It will be a combination of virtual courses like we've been doing for the past few months. So courses that are purely delivered virtually, and there will be a new hybrid format piloting, and ultimately we will unroll more and more of the hybrid format classwork as we get more comfortable and as we, as of course, health and safety conditions permit. And so with that in mind, what we're specifically talking about for August, for our incoming class, the first leadership residency, the LR1 residency, we are going to deliver fully virtual. The actual schedule will be will be designed to accommodate what virtual learning looks like these days in terms of durations and hours in front of the computer. But one of the guiding principle for us was starting off the program on equal footing for all of our incoming students to enable everybody to feel and engage with the program, at least at that entry point, the same way, regardless of their circumstances, where they're coming from, visa, no visa, high risk, not high risk. We want to make sure that we embrace all of our students in that first week of classes. And our team is working very hard to craft an exceptional program, given the circumstances, to make sure that we deliver on all of the, that impactful learning opportunity. Once we roll into Q1, so our first quarter, we have GEM, we have DA, we have some other courses. We will start diffusing some hybrid experiences, which are basically teaching physically a subgroup of students, given health and regulation restrictions, so socially distanced students in the classroom with masks, with a professor, and then approximately half of the class zooming in remotely to allow for what we call a hybrid class delivery. And we will be experimenting with that in Q1. We are equipping all of our classrooms in Roslyn and in Charlottesville with more advanced technology to enable this delivery. As you can imagine, it's not without challenges for both the students and the faculty in the room, and we need to make sure that the technology is there to support us. We have an unbelievable tech team. Gary, who's helping us out here today, is part of that. Really investigate and study the best tools to use, if that's tracking cameras to ensure that the faculty is being tracked in the room, or cameras that zoom into the students who are talking in the room, and also monitors and projections of the Zoom students who are coming in, and Wacoms for the faculty to be able to write on the board. So all of this is being put in place as we speak. Faculty are working to develop curriculum to accommodate, and that's going to be infused in our learning from Q1 for our incoming class and Q7 for our rising group. And it's a new world for us. We have not done our instruction this way until now, and so everybody's going to be learning together. We are confident in our capabilities online. We're confident in our capabilities on Zoom. We're confident in our capabilities in terms of case delivery online, which has its own challenges. And the hybrid format is just the next evolution in that direction. We're being very thoughtful to make sure that we can satisfy specific pedagogy concerns. And the whole team is working around the clock to ensure that that occurs. So that's coming up. I'm excited. I know I'm going to learn new skills. I've been experimenting with online for over a decade now. I have a course on Coursera. I've been teaching in online certificates. I've been doing a lot of online instruction, and I wrote a case on higher ed transformation with Harvard Business School just now. And so I've been really excited about the space before COVID happened. And now with the COVID situation, we're forced to innovate, but I think ultimately good things will come out of it.
Yeah, I'm glad you made the point about the class starting together. I think we all feel very strongly about this as a cohort-based experience, right? And I think it would have felt strange to us as well as students in the class to have some people together, some people online as they take that first step as a class. I know we had 2 months or so of meetings. We continue to meet as a working group, but that was a really important value, particularly given the sort of the values of our institution and culture of you know, Darden, the sort of emphasis on community.
And let me just add to that, Brett. So thank you for pointing that out. And I agree, and I feel passionately about that too. The topic of the residency is all about leading change. It's also going to have a focus on working in teams, giving voice to the quieter members of teams, or giving voice to all members of the team, working with vulnerable groups, working with inequality, and what we can do as a leader to lead change in our organizations, to defend those who need help and support in different ways. And as part of that vision, even more so, more than ever, thinking about all the different groups and the populations that we have in our incoming class, and thinking about our community in totality and how that community needs to receive our support in various formats and various ways, this seems like the obvious choice. This is what will allow us all to feel on equal playing field from the get-go, and to create that bond initially, and then we can experiment and deviate from that starting point, knowing that we are, you know, uniform in our approach from the get-go. We can use that as a platform to deepen our relationships, deepen our capabilities, and then segue and experiment in little groups and little discussions and little and many different creative ways. And in some ways, this is true for many Darden experiences. That principle has always been our guiding principle, meaning we want to make sure that the incoming students feel very similar in their experience and have that joint core. You know, we're one of the only schools that still have a core, and this is just another manifestation of that.
As I was hearing you sort of talk about this kind of, again, multidimensional decision-making process, reminded of a topic we've talked about periodically here on the podcast, is the idea of stakeholders and stakeholder theory, that you need to think about a lot of different people when you make decisions.
Yeah. And so Ed Freeman, you know, a good friend and esteemed colleague, his office is across the hall from mine, although I haven't been in the building for a long time, but he, the founding father of stakeholder theory. It's interesting when you talk to Ed, I don't know if you've ever interviewed him, Brett, for this podcast, but you may consider it. He says that there aren't trade-offs. He doesn't believe in trade-offs. He doesn't think that every problem needs to be presented as a trade-off, which obviously, you know, goes a little bit against my line of research. So it's interesting to have those conversations, sometimes a little bit philosophical. But Ed's perspective, which I actually think is very useful, is that situations like we're facing now could and should, under good leadership, result in a win-win outcome. It should result in a situation where we all benefit and grow from it. And so thinking about that and shape, you know, thinking about that and how it pertains to some of these decisions, we will all benefit from these joint experiences, and we will benefit from working as a group, as a cohort, and developing that cohort bond, because long term, that's really what's going to last. And that's more meaningful than a lot of other more minor details. And so, you know, I need to focus on Ed's message and not so much take I can put weights in an Excel spreadsheet. I need to move away from that and think like Ed Freeman, that ultimately it's not a trade-off. It's a win-win situation and a win-win outcome for all the parties involved.
Well, Ed Freeman is certainly on our list of podcast invitees. We're working through that. There's so many people that we want to talk to here at Darden. I wish we had a daily podcast, because I think we
next evolution.
Absolutely. So just as we wrap up here, Yael, you've worked with Darden students for a number of years. You've seen students start the program. You've had them in decision analysis. You've been around grounds for a while. What would be a tip or a piece of advice you might share for our listeners as they're who are starting in our class of 2022 as they're preparing for their experience?
Yes, I think my sense is that Darden is a place that you get the most out of when you come in looking to learn. Like, you're not looking to show that you know, but you're looking to learn. And I think that we are fortunate to have one of the most supportive communities and classroom vibes that I've seen, probably the most supportive classroom atmosphere that I've seen, where people really want to hear you thinking out loud, hear you make mistakes, but then recognize that and fix it, help you find the light. And we do it in a very supportive and humble way. And so when folks come into the classroom saying, I'm here to learn from my classmates, from the professor, from the dialogue, then they invest in asking questions and taking gambles and listening to the one conversation in the room and helping connect those open links or helping a student or, you know, coming in attuned to where folks are struggling and trying to jump in and help in those moments. I think that's where people grow and learn the most. And it's not just about, oh, I know this topic, or I don't know this topic, or I think I know this topic, because we're not just here to satisfy like some kind of list of, you know, knowledge buckets, but we're here to grow as individuals. And when students come in with that mindset, I'm here to learn about myself, I'm here to learn about the topics, I'm here to learn about others, then they get the most out of it. And it's an amazing transformation to observe. Some students walk in day one ready for that. Some students need, you know, one quarter to kind of get to that place where they recognize just how much they can benefit back in many different ways. It could be surely, you know, it could be that formula in Excel, but it could also be just something about themselves, something about how they express themselves or how they listen to others. Incredibly hard skill for a lot of us. And so if you come in with that mindset, I'm here to learn and to really grow myself in new ways from the community itself, then you'll get a huge amount from the experience. So that would be my advice. It's a mindset. It's a mentality. And that's the biggest thing that you can do to benefit the most and enjoy the ride throughout the next 2 years.
It's great advice. And I was talking with some of our 2020s. I've had a few phone calls with them. You know, obviously they've just graduated and they all miss being in class. They all miss being around their classmates and seeing everyone and having those conversations. And I think it says a lot about that learning mindset. So they're now all trying to figure out how do I do another program? How do I do more professional certifications? How do I read more books? Learning mindset is a great way to be, not just while you're here, but as you move forward in your career.
Yes, I am very, again, part of the joy of being a professor, but part of the joy of being in the Darden community, I think that's true for staff and faculty and students, of course, is that we're so lucky to sit around and talk about interesting, challenging problems, learn every day, and have the ability to invest in ourselves and in others in this way. It's just a very fortunate and it's, you know, it's mission driven and it's inspiring in so many ways to develop, you know, the responsible leaders of tomorrow. But it's also just such a great community of thoughtful people that you walk away enriched with every conversation, whether that's a first coffee, you know, a virtual first coffee, or whether that's a session on online shopping that I delivered yesterday, or whether that's a heartful conversation around social injustice. They are powerful in their own way, and they're special in their own way, and they're important. And this is a community that wants to embrace in those conversations and help each other make sense of the world around them.
Well, Yael, I know how busy you are because we were on so many Zoom meetings together, but I so appreciate you taking time out for the podcast. It was a pleasure having you here. And, you know, we're so excited to have you leading our executive MBA program. And, you know, I can't wait to welcome our new students in August.
Thank you so much, Brad. Thank you for inviting me. And, you know, I look forward to the ride with you and many others.
And that was my interview with Yael Grushka-Gakane. As always, if you have any comments, suggestions, requests, anything you'd like for us to cover here on the podcast, we're all ears. We can be reached at exec, that's E-X-E-C, MBA at darden.virginia.edu. And until next time, stay safe, be well, and thanks for listening.